Good morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Make New Haven tick, flood, pack an emergency bag, and hide for shelter while the gas tank is full. Yes, I'm talking about the era of climate change, where it used to be once every 10 or 20 years we'd have a monster storm that shut the city down and everyone's scared they'd lose power, wouldn't have water, might have to flee. Now it seems like it's every few weeks, potentially sometimes. And we're going to talk to a man on the front line of dealing with climate change in New Haven, how we're going to fix it short-term and long-term. His name is Giovanni Zinn. He's the city engineer. Giovanni, thanks so much for making time to come in today.
Hey, thank you, Paul, for having me on here. It's been a little bit, but I certainly have enjoyed being on the station, and brings me back to the days of Infrastructure Thursdays
with
Doug
Housleton.
Yes, we should.
You know, it's interesting. City engineer has always been an important job, and it's usually the person you never hear about. Now, would you agree that in the era of climate change, city engineer is an out front position that requires long extra hours about emergencies of flooding, short-term and long-term, how we're going to change with rising sea levels so the city doesn't flood, but also keep our grid up, how we're going to change to greener energy and all that?
Yeah, I think it's it is the critical question, certainly in our time here, on how do we deal with this existential threat that we caused ourselves. And it's something that certainly consumes a lot of our time and our thought, and it colors everything that we do. City government is often focused on short-term issues. What's the fire of the day? What's the next budget cycle? What's the next couple years? We have this big existential threat, which is not only a giant problem now, but it's going to be an increasing problem as you go forward. The state of Connecticut's official forecast for sea level rise, for example, is up to 20 inches by 2050.
Our sea level is going to rise 20 inches to 2050.
Up to 20 inches by 2050. That's out of Jim O'Donnell out of UConn Circa. Is sort of our technical lead in the state, if you will.
Is that for New Haven too?
Yeah, for the Connecticut shoreline. That's really a big issue for us. We're a coastal community. We're in a sense paying a heavy price for the sins of everyone, even people who live thousands of miles from or a thousand miles.
Okay,
from
we talked about how this is different. We talk about existential threat about like what's the crisis today. For instance, you've been working for years on a plan for Long Wharf, a plan for One Union Avenue. You have maps for coastal flooding all over the city, so that even Beaver Hills, which isn't on the water, has to think about this. But you are also scrambling with the quote-unquote fire of the day.
Yes.
So there was an article, tell me if you think this was accurately portrayed in the media, said that one-third of the people in America in the last 3 months have experienced a weather crisis event. They've had to leave their homes because of wildfires that are going much farther than ever before and destroying an entire village in one case. They're having flooding, flash flooding in Tennessee. People don't even see coming. That destroys homes and turns roads into rivers. We had, since Hurricane Katrina, in some ways, the worst storm in New Orleans. And then just a couple weeks ago, we thought we could get hit in New Haven. The major Deegan Expressway in New York was a river.
Yeah.
Is that accurate to say that we're all going to be living now every few months prepared for a possible crisis, like weather blows out at the last second, like happened with Hurricane the hurricane right before Ida, the one that hit Rhode Island instead of us,
right.
Henri.
Henri, yes.
Are we going to have to batten down the hatches every few months now?
I mean, predicting the weather is always a tricky thing, but certainly we see the longer-term trends are towards more frequent, more severe weather events. So are we going to, over a period of time, have to batten down the hatches more often? Absolutely. The rule to the two-pronged challenge that we see in New Haven from climate change is the sea level rise, but also an increase in these high intensity rain events. And we've had two of them this summer, Elsa and Ida, both of which caused extensive flooding, some of which flooded the same people twice.
Although in both cases, especially Ida, if we had been 50 miles away, it would have been much, much worse, right?
Right, yeah.
Like New York and New Jersey, people's homes were destroyed, right? And thousands, millions of people, right, lost electricity. Right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of these issues are also hyper-local, right? Different parts of New Haven saw different amounts of rainfall and substantially different amounts of rainfall.
Well, did we dodge a bullet with Henri and Ida the last month? I mean, because Henri, when I looked at the first map 3 days before and he gave us that briefing, it showed it hitting New Haven. Like hitting New Haven.
Yes.
In which case, thousands, tens of thousands of people would have lost power, maybe for a week, right?
Yeah. I mean, Henri was, no question, a bullet dodged. I think both Elsa and Ida were, we took those, you know. Could they have been worse? Sure. Could they have been a lot better? Absolutely. So
are most of the trees that were going to fall down, I mean, there are always some ready to fall, but... did we have a kind of priming?
Well, neither were particularly high wind event days. I mean, really, the summer
2020, right. We had that huge one. We had a 100-year tree fall.
Well, it was, Isaias. That was a wind event, right? So we've seen, you sort of go through the different events that we've seen over the last 10 years or so. You know, Sandy was a storm surge event, really. That was one of the big things that we saw there, and some wind. Not so much on the rainfall. You look at Isaias, that was a real wind event. Elsa and Ida were really rainfall events, where we saw this large amount of water. And we've even seen a couple of, this was a year or two ago, Hampden had 8 inches of rain, right? These sort of hyper-local cells that dumped this huge amount
just
of
like
water.
Just like in 89, Hampden, the tornado touched down early in Hampden and everywhere else and wiped out a block.
Yes.
Remember that?
I remember that.
I really think they're cursed.
Yeah, well, Hampden's my hometown where I grew up, I was a proud green dragon of Hampden High, so.
But I do think they seem to get hit by a lot more of those.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in Hampden, we always thought Wallingford got all the thunderstorms. They just passed right to the north
of
us.
But their electricity didn't come out because even though they're a Republican town, they have publicly owned municipal power.
Yes.
Which is cheaper and stronger.
Oh, yeah. It's the envy of the state, right?
Yeah. Well, I wish we could have that. But anyway, we're talking to Giovanni Zinn. He's a city engineer. He's on the front lines of climate change. So he talked about, when there's a big rain event, meaning a flood.
Right.
Always, correct? Middletown Avenue, it's going to flood under the highway. Quinnipiac Avenue, there's going to be flooding. Union Avenue and Longworth is going to be flooding.
Right.
But isn't it true that in this last storm, you put up roadblocks, right? You said, don't drive here on Middletown Avenue.
Yes.
And people drove around the roadblocks and got stuck and had to be towed out.
It is an amazing lesson in human behavior.
I mean, what do you pull your hair out saying, I'm up all night trying to keep people safe in New Haven? We both warned them with words. We put up a roadblock so they couldn't go there, and they still drove around and got stuck.
Yeah, I mean, it's, every time there's one of these events, I end up interacting with people who've had their vehicles destroyed in the flood, and they show a lot of regret, and I certainly don't blame them. And I feel bad for them. But on the other hand, don't drive in flooded streets. Don't drive around a police cruiser that has flashing lights that's clearly telling you, don't keep going. If you drive around them and try to forge your way through, don't be surprised if your engine destroys itself by taking in a bunch of water. And it's all fun and games as long as no one gets hurt. But there is the very, very serious possibility that someone does die because of this. I mean, we certainly saw with I think it was a state trooper in Woodbury that got caught up in a flood. Yeah. They're tragedies.
This is serious business.
And floods are tragedy.
And I think when my mind turned on this, I don't know if this was the same for you, it was 2010 to 2013, when all of a sudden we had three or four storms that were the kind you would get once every 40 years. I'm talking about a freak October snowstorm that the trees still had the leaves, so that pulled everything down. You had the biggest snow since the 1800s, Snowmageddon, with almost 3 feet, and a number of other snow events like that. So is cold weather going to be something to worry about more because then you have to add with the snowfall?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. I'm not a meteorologist, so to be frank, I think the summer rainfall has sort of been, the hurricane season rainfall has been one of our major focuses. But yeah, I think increasing snowfall and the challenge that we have when basic infrastructure such as our electric grid fails.
What are we doing about the electric grid?
Well, I mean,
Well, you like trim trees, and people are mad about that.
Right.
That's a pro and con. We love trees, too. And
yes.
You need them for the climate, but you also don't need them falling on poles.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real challenge. It's regulated at the state level, I think partially by design. So the city does not have a particularly active role other than our role as the tree warden. And in advocating for the tree cover, which, you know, helps a lot with, urban heat island effect, reducing energy consumption. There's a lot of air quality, benefits for trees, right? And finding that balance can be so hard sometimes.
Yeah.
I think we're at a crossroads on two different fronts. One is the sort of the resilience side for the electric grid, and then the second is obviously electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Are going to mean a lot of different things for the electric grid.
What's it going to mean? We need more electricity to charge.
Yeah, I mean, like we were, I did an exercise a couple months ago, and we're thinking over what does it mean for our police cruiser fleet to become 100% electric, right?
Is that going to happen?
I think everyone's going to be electric in the next 10 years, right? I mean, Europe is banning combustion engines in 2035.
And all the major car companies are
wrapping
it up.
I drive one of our city vehicles that's fully electric. It's great. I mean, clearly you're driving the
future.
Can
you go more than 50 miles?
Yeah, I think I don't go more than 50 miles. I mean, one of the nice things about Zoom is I don't think I've left the city on business in a very long time.
Nice.
And I'm looking forward to not having to do that. You know, travel time is obviously something that takes a lot of time.
Especially when you have kids.
Yeah, exactly. Looking at the police fleet, we got 50-something cars that are three shifts, and how do you charge all of that?
What
right?
did you decide?
Well, it's basically you'd have to use like a fast charger. You know, a half hour gets you back to 80%. Aside from the cost of that,
isn't the technology going to improve so that you will be able to charge faster?
Well, yes. I mean, but when you're charging faster, that increases your electricity draw. So suddenly to charge our police fleet all at the same time on a fast charger, which is conceivable, it's a power draw of like 5 megawatts, which is similar to like our entire wastewater treatment plant. You know, it's really one of the larger, it would be a very large user. Much more than, our city buildings or something. You know, one building like our city hall complex, for example.
So that'd be an example of a problem you haven't figured out yet, but you've identified.
Right, yeah. So as we go forward, but I think that, that's one small example. And
that's a good problem.
You pull that out, to look at the entirety of the grid and all the challenges that we're going to have as we make this big and very necessary transition to EVs. Couple that with the resilience, I think we're going to see big changes in our electric grid. I don't know.
I want to ask you about that. So you might have noticed when I ask you questions, especially for articles, I really don't know what I'm talking about, the basics of engineering, right?
That's not true.
No, it is true, but that kind of helps me explain it to everybody else. If you can explain to me what you're good at, we can explain to the best. So here's something I'd like you to explain to me.
Sure.
We have a double threat for our electric grid. We have, besides the fact that we want it to be green to save the planet, we have the threat of storms that knock down wires, right, and people are in danger. And there's hacking, right? So
right.
We know that government, quasi-government, and rogue actor hackers around the world, North Korea, Russia, Estonia, everywhere you look, they could shut down our grid.
Sure.
Why haven't we moved to microgrids? Why haven't we just had my neighborhood either? So now I have solar panels, right?
Yeah.
But I have to send that electricity back to UI. UI buys it retail, sends it back, and charges you wholesale. And they say that's for the good of the grid. We could talk about that another day. I think that's BS. But you also lose a lot of energy along the way and is still vulnerable to hackers and storms.
Right.
Why aren't we at completely localized, generated? Because, that could skip the whole thing about burying power lines, which is so expensive, but guards against the weather. Why aren't we doing that?
To be honest, I'm not an expert in that field, so much. I mean, we've obviously done a lot of projects around.
I don't mean to be a survivalist. I just don't understand why that isn't our plan.
Well, I think it's because we've the whole grid was built on this system of very large centralized power plants.
Why aren't we ditching that? Is it too expensive?
I think it's both expensive to do that, but I think there's also a lot of entrenched investments that are in those large centralized
inherited
assets.
By, in the case of UI, a Spanish energy giant, which has a pretty good green record, right? But I don't know. But it's they really are. I would say they have too many friends in government who are looking out for their profits. No,
I think that's okay. Certainly a possibility.
What if a lot of us are getting solar? We can get more. Why aren't we just having batteries that store it so that we don't have to send it back to a grid and have it be subject to shutdowns? I know we need the backup of a grid, perhaps, for cars fails, or if you have like 5 days of overcast skies.
Well, I actually installed a solar array myself on my house this last December, right before the weather turned. I didn't want to be on my roof in the cold, but I looked at batteries. I mean, it's just a question of cost still on batteries.
Do you think that'll come down in 5 years?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, I think
so. If you have a backup generator and a battery,
right?
Will we need to be on the grid?
I think there's certain times when we do, another big push is for building electrification, right? For climate change, right? To get away from natural gas and from fossil fuels.
So we want more electricity now. And some of us would argue nuclear power because then environmentalists were against nuclear power because of the waste and the danger. But other people say, in fact, if it's done right, it's the cleanest. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I think one of the challenges you have is that the cleaner technologies in the home rely on electricity. So we're trying to push those, and at the same time, we're also trying to, have things like battery backup. Yeah. And the size of your equipment just keeps going up and up and up, for battery backup
and, then
and inverters
too,
and all that.
Whether it be for the metals or for the actual parts.
Yeah. I mean, you could secure them in your basement.
We are getting a survival scheme here now. We got our rifles and don't come near our house. But But won't the cost for that come down, too?
I think a lot of the cost will come down.
Now, here's a crazy, crazy, crazy idea. Could the police electric vehicles have solar roofs?
They could. I think some of the manufacturers have done it. It's a more or less an inconsequential amount of energy compared to the quantity of energy that the car needs.
All right. So now I'd like to bring it right back to Earth because we got Giovanni Zinn, who's at Ground Zero location Earth at all the storms and other climate change challenges facing New Haven. You listen to us on Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM, New Haven's home for community radio. So, Jim and I, we've been talking about resilience. That's a word for how we're going to still be around when those sea levels rise. Will there be a Morris Cove in 2050? Will there be an airport?
Well, that's an interesting question. You said the A word there, right? The airport. It's a concern, right? I mean, everyone talks about how low the airport is. I think there's less discussion about the fact that the neighborhood right next to it is basically at the same level, within inches in certain spots of the airport. It's a real challenge. I think.
What level is it at?
The lowest spot in the neighborhood is the intersection of Morris Causeway and Concord, and the catch basin top there is just below elevation 4. So,
what does that mean?
It means that in a very high tide, like a lunar high tide, right now the harbor is at the level of the catch basin. So there's a tide gate, right? That really changes all of this. So if you look at the inundation maps that FEMA publishes, and a lot of other places publish, they show all of that area flooding regularly, not only the airport, but also the neighborhood.
So can we build protection so that for 100 years we're okay, or should we more intelligently just move people out?
Well, I think that's one of the big challenges we have, right? Globally, talking about this issue in coastal communities. Right. I think there's certainly a thread where people say you have to just pull back. It's no longer sustainable. I think in New Haven, we have a challenge, right? Climate is a huge challenge. It's not the only challenge. It's providing housing for our affordable housing for our people, jobs, economic opportunity. And I think, a lot of the sort of strategic value of New Haven is the fact that it's a coastal community. It's at the center of a bunch of transportation networks. So, I don't think pulling back necessarily is the correct answer.
We can protect ourselves. We can build enough protection so that even Morris Causeway will be a viable place to live in 2040.
I think there are ways of doing that. I think the big challenge is going to be, how do we fund all of that? How do we pay for all of these different issues, right?
The word is infrastructure. When we're talking about the politics of what's going on in Washington, you're talking about your livelihood, right?
Right.
How do we build stuff so that we don't
fight? Right, exactly. How do we show New Haven's value as we compete against every other coastal community? If you look at Long Wharf, the Army Corps has selected us as part of their feasibility study of New Haven and Fairfield counties. They selected Long Wharf as the project to go forward for protection.
Tell us what that project is.
So that project essentially has three elements. One is building a flood wall along I-95 to protect the I-95, the Long Wharf district that's between the I-95 and the rail yard, and then the rail yard. And then even a little bit beyond.
That's important.
So that's element one, yes.
Trains can run, cars can move, people can work and live.
And, you know, the Long Wharf Responsible Growth Plan, you know, talks about the value of this district.
You also have very good drawings in that plan.
Yeah, I got to say, hand it to
we
my
like
friends
it.
In City Plan. They do beautiful
we love
rendering.
Running the stories comedy so we can run those drawings. You can see what you're talking about.
Right. And then, you know, element number two is a large pump station, you know, 1,000 cubic feet per second. It's a huge amount of water that we have to pump out. There are times when water will be high in the harbor and water just has nowhere to go.
What can we pump now?
I'm sorry.
How many cubic feet per second can we
Well, we don't have a stormwater pump.
We don't have any stormwater
pump. Yeah, right now we're relying on gravity. And, you know, as the sea level rises, you know, we talk about gravity. It's water flows downhill, right? If you get rid of your hill, the water doesn't flow anywhere. So you then are stuck using a pump that, you know, essentially creates a hill.
This is part of why we can't leave the police station, the train station, when it rains hard.
Right, exactly, yeah. I mean, and especially when there's high tide. You know, Union Avenue there's at elevation 8. You know, in a storm, you see, you know, storm surge, not crazy storm surge. You know, you're elevation 5, 6, you know, even up to 7. And suddenly what is usually, you know, 5, 6-foot drop at normal
so
high tide.
So do you guys, in advance of a bigger storm, move the police cruisers somewhere else?
We do move some of our assets into the garage at Union Station because you can get out the other way. You know, the police do have ways of moving things around, but it's a challenging spot. And it's a challenge also because that entire district is a place of growth in New Haven,
right.
A place for economic opportunity.
And theoretically, they were going to rebuild the Church Street South, right?
Right. Yeah. So there's, you know, I think they're talking hundreds of units there of, you know, also of affordable for housing.
And what's the third element of this long?
It's gates at the open, at the highway and the underpasses, right? So water can get under the underpasses at Brewery, at Canal Dock and Long Wharf Drive. So be able to close those off so water can't get under the highway.
Gates you can close off. So but where does the water go, though?
Well, it just stays in the harbor, right? But the volume of water in the harbor is so much larger than the volume that you have going into Long Wharf, even though it would destroy Long Wharf.
So these three projects, how much does it cost?
Right now, the Army Corps is looking at $130 million.
And when is it being built?
Well, that remains to be seen, right? It has to get funded first.
Oh, they haven't funded
it? They haven't fully funded it. No, they've funded their work. They have the first year of design funded. So that's going to start here in 2022, hopefully. And then sort of there's a multi-year design process and then construction probably in the mid to late 2020s.
So we're a decade away.
Sorry?
We're a decade away.
Where did what get
away? We're a decade away from
a decade away. Yes, yes.
So what are we going to do in the meantime?
I mean, what we currently do, right?
And what do we do besides begging people not to drive into floods?
I think there's that. You know, certainly as we see redevelopment, you have to follow our redevelopment standards, you know, build to the base flood elevation plus one, looking at ways to strengthen that.
Can you walk me through that again? Because, again, people like me don't really know baseline.
Right. So, you know, per building code and our flood management regulations, if you're, say, in a flood district, you have to build where your finished floor elevation is above the base flood elevation. So FEMA publishes a map that says, you know, and I'm making up numbers here, but, you know, in Long Wharf District, you have a flood elevation of elevation 12, right? So you would have to build your floor at elevation 13.
Is that already outdated? Are we now going to once a year be above 13?
Well, I think as you see FEMA revising flood maps, that goes up. No, we haven't seen elevation 13. 12 is a 100-year flood, and we haven't seen that.
We just had the 100-year flood in New York and New Jersey, and it missed us by like 50 miles.
Well, I think that was a rainfall as opposed to storm surge.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, so a storm surge is to elevation 12. Rainfall...
So you feel like we can live in the future on the East Shore and even have Tweed, we just have to fight for the infrastructure dollars to protect them?
Yes. I think that's the big question is how do we show New Haven
you know, something that deserves the investment to be protected? And how do we invest ourselves now and do the little things now that, you know, sort of will save us the big bucks down the line?
Mm. So what's some of the other things we do now besides building the floor elevation?
Well, I think it's a lot of how we deal with stormwater, encouraging stormwater infiltration. I think we've been very successful in New Haven through both in the public right-of-way and our bioswales, but also in our regulations.
Now, are the bioswales make a difference? I mean, obviously, we love bioswales, right?
Yes.
Bioswales are where you have a little plot of dirt by the road, where you have plants and instead of grass there,
yeah,
and it absorbs the rainwater so it doesn't flood the streets. And we became bioswale city in the last 5 years. I mean, this must have been one of the most fun part of your jobs. And we even got people from Emerge who came out of prison, the Emerge program, to build them and learn how to do them.
Yeah.
And what a great thing. How many do we have now?
I think we're getting close to 300.
Wow. So what is, does that add up enough that it prevents floods?
It certainly helps. We had the Yale School of Forestry, Dr. Gabe Benoit, look at it. He did pre and post testing. I think I actually saw him out on where was he? Right out here on Orange Street, looking at one of his sensors yesterday. And he's looked at it, and yes, they do make a measurable difference and a significant difference. You know, obviously that varies depending on the storm.
I always feel like I'm singing Kumbaya
and
when I'm going through, because it sounds too good to be true. How the good ways a bioswale improves the city. Like, you just go on West Park Avenue, aren't there like three in a few blocks?
Yeah, that was actually one of the first sites, a pilot site. And that one was extensively studied by the Yale School of Forestry, and they found that to be pretty effective. I think the benefit there is that you're preventing water from entering our system at all. And so that the capacity that we do have is diminished as it sometimes
and
is.
And is there also an issue with, like, so you can't go in the water for a few days after a big storm because the sewage goes into the, into the, recreational areas? What is the status of our separated sewers? I remember we were building more separated sewers.
Right, so Greater New Haven Water Pollution Control Authority is the lead agency on that. They're the ones that are under the consent order, not the city. They have the long-term control plan, which is a 20-year plan to go through all the city and separate it. You know, but this is a problem that stays with us. You know, the consent order from EPA says that you have to separate the sewers for what's called a 2-year, 6-hour storm. So that's a storm that has a 1 in 50 chance of happening in any particular year. It's a fairly typical storm. 1 in 50, that sounds wrong. No. I'm sorry, I'm not doing my math. It has a 50% chance. There we go. 50% chance. Got my math flipped though. 1 in 2 chance. Yeah, that's a little different. A 1 in 2 chance of happening in a particular year, and then they have to control overflows for that.
So how are we doing with overflows, like around the city?
I mean, they still happen. They're going down, is my understanding.
Am I right? Is that what I see when I walk almost every day in Edgewood Park, and some days I see after a storm really scummy water near the channels and the duck pond?
It could be.
That's coming from the harbor, though, too. Right?
I mean, there's a lot of natural processes as well that create scum. You know, there's tannins and other things that kind of create that. You know, so that's going down. However, in these larger storm events, say an Ida or an Elsa, you know, those are way beyond a 2-year, 6-hour storm event. So that's something where we still will see CSOs into the future, even after this 20-year plan.
Wow.
So it's something
we're
going to
see a lot more of those storms.
Us. Yeah.
All right. Aaron Good has a question. I'm going to try to read it here because I just got to scroll it a little bit. When will the Grand Avenue, I'm sorry, there's another thing that's blocking my view of this photo, when will the Grand Avenue Bridge be reopened? When will the work along the Farmington Canal at the Learning Corridor be completed? When will we be getting raised intersections at the Farmington Canal at grade intersections? So start with Grand Avenue Bridge.
Grand Avenue Bridge, we are...
And by the way, you got the Chop Suey Bridge open in 3 days. Good job.
Yes.
You sound like hard to talk about.
The Grand Avenue Bridge was scheduled to be complete, again, right at the end of this year. We are still on schedule, despite the pandemic, to open in January.
Mm-hmm. With the democratically selected color.
With the democratically ranked choice voting selected color.
That was so much fun. Yeah.
Yes. So that is, you know, that project has been on schedule. We started days before the pandemic started. You know, I remember being on the bridge, I think it was the 7th of of March, we had our block party, right?
Remember that? The last time everyone was out in public for a
exactly.
while.
You know, and we're not shaking hands at that point, but that was about it.
Wow, so March 7th, we knew that.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I'm pretty sure it was March 7th. But
now we found out shaking hands is fine. We just can't sneeze on each other.
Right, yeah, exactly. So that's on track. We'll be probably closed for a day or two in April just to put the overlay because we can't do that in the winter. But it's, you know, I think the bridge is turning out beautifully. We're excited about the project and, have a long life ahead of it for that.
Work along the, now the Learning Cart is the place by West Hazel Street and Shelton Avenue that is one of the great spots in New Haven. It used to be the mud hole in the 90s,
yes.
big 80s, big drug dealing place. Now it's been reclaimed by the community, all these green spaces, community gardens. I was there the other day just seeing like 20 camp kids doing something with people.
Oh yeah, no, it's a fantastic place.
So what's the work being done along the Farmington Canal there?
So we have to connect an electric service, and we're working with our good friends at Parks and Public Works to get that scheduled. I hope to do that shortly.
And why do you want electric service on the
trail? For the lights and also for events. We're also extending the lighting in down the canal line 2 extra blocks.
That's a good idea.
Yep, yeah, and we're going to try to work our way up and down the canal line and have lighting. We've got those lights on order.
Have you hit the supply chain problem?
Oh, 100%. Yes, supply chain problems are huge. So we're looking at probably the end of the year to get those in.
Okay.
So that work is continuing. And then I think the third one was, you had one other question.
When will the raised intersections for the Farmington Canal at grade intersections be there?
So we're mostly through our design. It's a joint project with Hamden. So I got to check with Hamden on their timeline as well. I think they were trying to approve some capital funds for their match. We have our funds for our match. So I'll
Hamden
follow up.
Doesn't really have any money. Like if you look in their wallet, it's a big hole. In
yeah. There. That's what I've heard. I've read your coverage.
I got to tell you, I think that I got to believe that one way you do your job better is Aaron Good.
Oh, 100%.
That guy pays such great attention to many important things around town that the rest of us can't.
His Twitter feed is required reading.
It is really great. It's one of the best publications in town about commentary and facts. And
yes.
It picks out while testimonies going on at the legislature or, historic.
Yeah,
Aaron, thank you for that question, and thanks for keeping everybody on their toes. And we're doing that here on Dateline New Haven, WNHH-FM New Haven's home for community radio. We had the pleasure today to talk about disaster after disaster after disaster after looming disaster of climate change with Giovanni Zinn, the guy who gets to be up day and night worrying about it and keeping us safe. Giovanni, is this what you want to do when you were like 10?
Yeah, you're making me feel so good about what I do, right? You know, it's like, it's just doomsday, you know?
Actually, we're going to get to why it's the opposite. But anyway, did you ever want to do this when you were in Hamden?
So, I always loved the environment, right? I got a love for the environment actually from my older brother, and
Did you go to like Sleeping Giant and stuff a lot?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I actually remember my first engagement ever in New Haven civic life, and I was probably in, I don't know, second or third, I forget how old I was. It was, I don't know if you remember what was the name of that? It was in New Haven, like, in the early 90s, they had this whole process,
Vision Trail. Which I thought was hilarious. It was part of
that
was our early version of like having a walking trail that gets you under the highway by the train station so that you can walk through connecting cities that you didn't parts of the city you didn't realize were close together so you don't have to drive.
Right.
But then they put fences back up. I used to be like the only person for 3 days who would ride his bike under the trail there by the Brewery Street, and then they put the fences back up.
Yeah, no, I mean, Vision Trail, unfortunately, is no more through the rail yard, right?
But it was supposed to be how we're revisioning our but then we got the Farming Trail.
But there was this whole process, and I forget the name. Name's slipping me right now. Revisioning New Haven.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I remember going to, to one of the meetings about
second
the environment.
Grade? You did
I was
that?
Really young. I was in the, it was, I forget when it was. Do you remember when that was exactly? I could tell
I
you.
I covered it. Yeah, it was the early 90s.
Yeah, so I was probably,
93, 94.
Yeah, so I was probably about 10, you know. And
holy
I remember
crap,
going
you were 10 years old going to something like that instead of watching cartoons?
Yeah, no.
You could understand what they were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, my big suggestion, if I remember correctly, was to expand recyclables. So, you know, that was like all about that back then. It was so fun. Time,
did you foresee that China was going to stop accepting our recyclables?
No, I did not.
Dirty, and then we were somehow on the streets in Asia.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now I feel a little better.
But yeah, that's something I've always wanted to do.
What
so.
Got you at 10 years old to show up at a...
I just tagged along with my brother and my parents, and it was...
So they're kind of environmentalists?
They were active in sort of civic issues and stuff. And it was a big thing. I think it was an exciting time in New Haven at the time, from what I remember.
What was so funny is there was 8 million studies about how to make New Haven a whole different kind of place. And, you know, we made fun of it at the time, but New Haven did become a different place.
Yeah.
New Haven is a much different place from the 90s.
It is.
There's much more. I mean, Foreign Canal is just the beginning of it.
Yeah.
In terms of the civic engagement, whether it's arts, environment,
As someone who was born in the Haven Hospital, you know, it's really a wonderful
place. 10 years old, you're into environment. Were you also like into hiking and camping and stuff?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I don't think my parents weren't really into some of that
so
stuff. My
parents
were astronomers, so I was really into the stars, you know, and using my telescope and all that stuff. And I remember, Comet Hale-Bopp taking pictures and all that kind of thing.
And
so,
when did you say, I have an idea what I'd like to do with my life with this?
I think it was in college, actually. I mean, I always knew I wanted to go into, the sciences, right? I grew up in a very scientific household, and engineering.
Figure out how the toaster worked when you were trying?
Yeah, I always like pulling stuff apart. I was very practically minded, and working with tools and stuff. Like
and
my favorite class in high school was
it.
Home repair, right? Strangely
okay,
enough,
cool. It's not strange.
So I think engineering is a very good mix of the science, right? And I think to understand climate, you have to understand the science, and the science is really what guides us. And also there's the practical application. And I think working in engineering in the city really is the confluence of a lot of these different things, the science, the technical.
Did you do this right out of college?
Yeah. Yeah, I was an intern. Yep, in the planning department right after college.
Too funny, that's a great story.
And then I was back, basically.
What year are we talking about?
2005.
Okay, so it's the DiStefano administration.
Yep.
And 2006, I believe it was, or 2005 was when he got reborn as an environmentalist. So all of a sudden, he got his Prius.
Right, yeah.
He was running for governor as the Green governor.
Yep.
And so you kind of came at the ground floor when New Haven decided. It was also because the Green Party had won some elections in 2001.
Right.
So all of a sudden, Democratic Party decided they had to reinvent themselves as green because people liked that they rode their bikes around.
Yeah, I think there's also some very environmentally minded folks that came into City Hall. You know, Mike Piscatelli,
right?
You know, had started that and started a lot of wonderful work. With Karen Gilvarg in the planning department,
right.
Around. Doing a greenhouse gas inventory, then our air toxics inventory.
The city plan department this way?
Yeah, I was an intern there, and then I was away. I was doing environmental consulting for 10 months, and then there was an opportunity to come back under contract to work on some EPA grants, and the rest is history, as they say.
And has it always been the engineering department?
No, that was in planning. Then I was in the Office of Sustainability for a couple of years from 2010 to 12.
So your timing was good. You entered adult work career at the time New Haven entered the green era.
Yeah, I think you
and what did
say
you work on? Bike lanes. Remember we started with Sharrows, which now I think were well-intentioned and absolutely horrible idea. And then painted bike lanes, which everyone parks in or opens the doors in. So
right.
And then people like me ride the wrong way in, so that's actually not okay either.
Yeah, I mean, I think protected infrastructure is the future, and it's certainly what we hear from our community. I think it's a challenge in the city that's already built. You look at the design manuals and they show these, 80-100-foot right-of-ways out west that, you can fill with all sorts of goodies. And the challenge we have here that everything's a lot smaller and tighter. I think we're starting to really get some traction.
I watched you spend years with neighbors who were resistant so that you could plan a protected bikeway from Forest Road to all the way down Edgewood Avenue to where it ends at Park.
Yeah.
That was complicated. You had to talk to people how you're going to get up on their sidewalks. That took years, but now you're getting it built.
Yeah, it's getting built.
When's it going to be done?
I think we're going to be done with the civil construction here in probably about a month and a half.
Really? Because there's only two or three spots where you're working now.
Well, we're going through all the... So this is the civil construction. Then we have to do all the signal work. And that actually has been something that's been a challenge with COVID and all of the extremely long lead times. You know, you're getting lead times in the 20s and 30s of weeks. So, you know, that's always been, and that's a
what
it's
about
a
lead
challenge.
Times when you can get materials
yeah.
or people?
So you order it now and you get it 25 weeks later.
But right? This is going to be a protected two-way track.
Correct.
So, yep. Like, I'm looking, let's say, at Dwight and Edgewood.
Yeah,
I can't figure out what they're building there. They're just moving out the sidewalk. How's that a cycle track?
Right. So then it's two lanes. It'll be one travel lane, and it'll be the cycle track right next to the north curb.
But why are they pulling it out? Why are you taking away more of the street?
Well, it's not just a cycle track, right? This is also pedestrian improvements.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of all those intersections in the eastern part of Edgewood Avenue didn't have crosswalks, crosswalk signals. Also, you know, Dwight and Edgewood had a very long crossing distance, had this sort of sea of asphalt. Right?
And you have people who are disabled, something.
Right.
And a
yeah.
lot of pedestrian traffic.
And so you're asking people to, you know, you have a lot of neighbors talk about speeding there. And you have people wow. that are having to cross these very long distances.
And then by the Edgewood Mall, they call it
speed.
Which
yeah.
is that great greenway where yep. all these apple trees might. Daughter discovered with me the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that blooming apple's there. I noticed you're doing the same kind of work. I'm trying to think, is it not Ellsworth? It's like...
yeah, I forget all the different, which intersection we're on right now. I think we're at Norton now, if I remember
yeah.
correctly.
And what are you doing there? Is that, again, where you're cutting into the road?
So there we're putting in walk signals, I believe.
Mm-hmm. All yeah. right. And Giovanni's in. Dolores Kimbrough, thank you for listening. When you're coming to the neighborhoods, I think that means like neighborhood meetings. You go to management. Actually, you have teams yeah. in neighborhoods that we've covered, whether it's West Hills, Fairhaven, East Shore, where you actually have teams of citizens advising you on how to make streets safer, correct?
Right, yes. Yeah. So, you know, we're doing the Safe Routes for All projects. We also have our major corridors project where we're going to neighborhoods that, you know, have some of our larger arterials.
That's what I'm talking
ways
about,
to
yeah.
do those.
Like whether it's
yeah.
Valley Road,
anyone,
Street, yeah.
I'm happy to come see anyone. So,
how are those
yeah,
going?
Please reach out. They're going well. I mean, I think they're very well received. There's a lot of design challenges around them. You know, I was just walking Whitney Avenue the other day, and you know, there's a big giant AT&T duck bank right where we wanted to put a curb. So
uh-huh.
you have to keep adjusting and moving things and understanding. You know, there's a lot of congestion in our roads. You know, in terms of utilities.
And as you said, that's one of the
bigger challenges.
Do you have a fundamental belief, Giovanni Zinn, that changing the built environment will change behavior?
Well,
people drive
true,
like
yeah.
maniacs, pedestrians, we don't pay enough attention, our bikes.
Yeah.
Will we do better if you build things better?
Yeah, I think so. I honestly do believe so. You know, we often look at, not for everyone. I think there is a, you know, we talk about the three E's of traffic calming, education, enforcement, and engineering. Engineering is one part of that tripod. And we look at what's called the 80th percentile speed, you know, what speed people drive, 80% of people drive at or less, right? So if you have an 80th percentile speed of 25 miles an hour, that means that 80% of the drivers are driving the speed limit. That last 20%, right, that really becomes an education and enforcement issue.
So like right now, and I guess folks in Westville, I walk there a lot, on there are several parts of Yale Avenue that are treacherous. So
yeah.
It winds around wide.
Yeah.
So what you've done now, if you've built all these changes across from Edgewood School,
mm-hmm.
where the lanes are narrower and people are going to have to learn to park sort of in the middle of,
right.
of the car traffic and then to the side pedestrian bike. But then the neighborhood, I don't think it was the neighborhood. Wasn't it just like two or three people said, don't put rubber duckies up because they look ugly?
There was a number of people who did that.
So then
yes.
how are you going to actually get people to park where you want them to park so you can walk to the side of that?
I think a lot of people have figured it out at this point is what I'm hearing from the road. Are there still people that are parking in the wrong spot? Sure. I think that becomes an education.
I've actually been using the bike and walking. I really like it. And thank you.
Yeah. No, I think it works. I mean, there you had a road that was extremely wide. It had bike lanes that were just sort of traditional striped bike lanes between the parking lane and the traffic. So you had on one hand, you know, people opening their doors. On the other hand, you had people speeding by. You know, there wasn't a ton of bike traffic, so oftentimes people saw a travel lane that was probably, you know, 16 feet wide, so very wide, very flat, great sight lines, modern cars can go very fast. You know, yeah. I think that's a challenge, is that, you know, cars years ago were less capable than what they do now.
So my one corner that I consider the most dangerous.
Yes.
You're a block from the boulevard going west.
Uh-huh.
On Whaley.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going on the first entrance to Blake Street.
Yes.
That sweeps on a curve towards, so it's like double the size of a usual entrance. So when I walk in the middle of that block, when I start to walk, I look back and there are no cars coming. They come so fast, like 60, 80 miles an hour. They're not looking. They're texting. There's no way for a pedestrian not to be in the middle of the road and get killed. I can't tell you how many times I almost got killed, even on a bike on that.
This was crossing Blake Street or crossing Whaley?
Crossing Blake on Whaley.
Okay.
You know how it sweeps in at a curve? And that's all about the intersection, because sometimes people notice they almost killed you and they're like, they're sorry.
Well, I think that's the importance of intersection design.
So if
that's
a 91% angle, we're looking at. But can you do that if it's a state road?
Well, that's the challenge, right? Looking at what we can do and can't do because it's a state road. Certainly similar intersections designs. You know, if you look at Quinnipiac and Hemingway, for example, similar, you know, people can take a big sweeping turn. We did a temporary project with paint and delineators that I think was successful in necking that down. The permanent project that we're looking for 2022 on Quinnipiac Avenue permanently brings that neck down and to a 90-degree angle.
And you could do that on a state road.
Well, that's a Quinnipiac Avenue is a city road.
Okay, and then on this case is Blake City, so you can go a
Blake
few
is
feet.
City.
Could you go a few feet in and make the 90% there?
It's possible. I think you want to make sure that there aren't any weird jogs or anything like that you have to do. And as much as I love designing on the fly, it usually gets me in trouble. But
right. Well, not in trouble, but you're on Dateline New Haven, WNHHF, Giovanni's English. Just a few minutes left. Tell me quickly about solar roofs and solar power in city buildings. Since you've been engineer, and before that, I think an assistant or whatever.
Right.
You converted a lot of the city's buildings.
Yeah, we've got
to solar power. Tell me about that.
We've gotten about 3 megawatts of solar power on our roofs, schools mostly, in the sort of, and we've done it through public-private partnerships where the city locks in an electric rate for 15 to 20 years. And buys the power from the owner of the array,
which is.
In our case, it's a tangle of LLCs usually, but Tesla, it was a precursor to Tesla that did sort of the first round.
What happens in 15, 20 years?
They have to take them off the roof, or we can come to some sort of renegotiate some sort of arrangement. I mean, if the panels are long since paid for at that point.
And they don't go into the grid?
They do. I mean, they're net metered, right? So that means that the school sort of takes the power first, right? So usually schools consume plenty of electricity, and there's probably few times when the panels are really exporting a ton of power out of the schools, as opposed to your house, where the annualized production of your solar array in your house is probably matches or is very close to what you use in a year. You know, school, you're talking about, you know, 5-10%, something like that. So schools are very hungry for power, and so they tend to use it first. But what's nice about net metering and why that works very well is that we're able to take credit for the entire retail cost of the electricity. So that's not just the generation cost, it's also the transmission and distribution cost. Oppose that to, say, putting a solar array on an empty piece of land, then you're sort of just stuck selling the generation costs into the grid, and you don't get the transmission distribution.
Q House.
Yes.
You have played a big role in that.
We are days away from actually finishing the construction. Then we have to outfit it, right, with furniture and all of that.
When's it going
to
be open?
That is not for me to announce, I'll put it that way. Very shortly, though.
Like next week, or people going to be going?
No, I mean, I think one of the challenges that COVID has actually thrown is, you know, first of all, supply chain issues. But one of the supply chains that's really rough right now is actually the furniture supply chain. So we're, I think, getting our first deliveries next week. But it's kind of, we've got a few week process here of getting our furniture and, you know, stuff that was supposed to arrive, you know, 2 weeks ago is now shipping next week. And it's been a real challenge, both not only in terms of the manufacturer, but also the trucking shortage that the country's having right now.
All right. And then tell me, how can people make a killing on climate change? What's going to be the investments that in the new technology that help us deal in 20 years with how to live with flooding and fires and wind and...
Yeah, I really don't know. we were talking about it earlier a little bit. I think your point that it's probably not going to be the good guys that make the killing. While cynical,
hedge funds and oil companies.
I kind of feel that a bit myself. But I think it's less about making the killing. It's about finding creative ways to deal with it and to make sure that it doesn't stop everything else.
And is it worth it? The way your job has become more intense than you could have ever imagined. Do you like doing this job? Do you see yourself doing it a long time?
I do love being in the public sector. I think there's you get to deal with a wide range of questions and problems that you wouldn't necessarily get. And I think there's the human aspect to your work that is very different from, say, a for-profit area. So I really do love it.
And you get to fix things.
Yeah. No,
your job is solving problems.
It is, hopefully.
Isn't that nice?
I know there's a lot more problems to solve, and I got to keep getting up and trying to solve more.
You get a bridge put back in place. You get a street so people can drive on it. You get places people can walk and bike. You get sun-powering buildings so that our planet can be saved. I mean, that's not shit.
Yeah. No, there are many wonderful things about this work, and I do love it. Thank you.
Well, I am so appreciative that you took an hour off that work, Giovanni, to fill us in. We should get back to Infrastructure Thursday. I guess you don't have Doug anymore in that job. But
yeah, but we'll figure something out.
All right, that's a great idea. Giovanni Zinn, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, people, for listening today. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Fly free with us all day and all night. WNHH, New Haven's home. The Community Radio.